I do hope that our friends would be careful and appreciative of the way we set this matter forth, for we have a zeal for God's honor, I trust, as much as all. It is not a teaching we are setting forth that God is forcing men to sin or making them act contrary to their wills or anything of the kind. It is rather that man has been constituted by God in a certain way, and he has been given a heart which God created in him, which is full of evil. And if we will simply look at simple principles in nature that Christ appeals to, I think that this is a simple matter that we can grasp just as easily as we can grasp, if we're not stubborn, what I have said a number of times concerning if something is caused, then it has to be, and if it isn't caused, it can't be prevented. That is very satisfactory and simple. And likewise, it's very satisfactory and simple to see that God has created man with such a heart as he has. And to take the illustration of a tree, in Matthew 12:33, either make the tree ideal and its fruit ideal, or make the tree rotten and its fruit rotten. Verse 34, progeny of vipers, how can you be speaking what is good, being wicked? For out of the superabundance of the heart, the mouth is speaking, you see. And if a good man out of his good treasure is extracting good things, and the wicked man out of his wicked treasure is extracting wicked things. And the thing is that anything that is good has to come from God, for there is one who is good, as Christ himself said. There's no goodness in man built in, you might say. If there's a man who, even in a relative sense, is a good man, that goodness that he does have is something that God has given to him. You cannot get anything except it is given to you from heaven. John 3:27. And what do you have but what you've received? 1 Corinthians 4. Well, I think that's a good testimony on this. And similarly, in Romans 9, where Paul cites from Isaiah, in verse 29, from Isaiah 1, verse 9, except the Lord of hosts conserved us a seed. It's a form of the word salvation, like a conservation program. Except the Lord of hosts conserved us a seed, as Sodom would we become, and to Gomorrah would we be likened. It's just a simple thing that we in ourselves are constituted in such a way that there will be nothing good and only evil come from us when left to ourselves. And if we are to do good in any sense, in any way, to any degree, it must be a goodness which God puts in us and fulfills through us. There's an illustration that might be helpful to help us to see this concerning the sun and the heat in the day and the cold at night. As there is a vast difference between the suns being the cause of the lightsomeness and warmth of the atmosphere, I'm quoting again from Edwards here on page 160, and brightness of gold and diamonds, that is, there's quite a difference between the suns being the cause of the lightsomeness and the warmth of the atmosphere, and brightness of gold and diamonds, by its presence and positive influence, and its being the occasion of darkness and frost in the night, by its motion whereby it descends below the horizon. The motion of the sun is the occasion of the latter kind of events, but it is not the proper cause, efficient, or producer of them, though they are necessarily consequent on the motion under such circumstances. No more is any action of the divine being the cause of the evil of men's wills, you know, in that sense. We have to be very careful how we use these terms. If the sun were the proper cause of cold and darkness, it would be the fountain of these things, as it is the fountain of light and heat. And then something might be argued from the nature of cold and darkness to a likeness of nature in the sun, and it might be justly inferred that the sun itself is dark and cold, and that its beams are black and frosty, but from its being the cause, no otherwise than by its departure, no such thing can be inferred. But the contrary, it may justly be argued that the sun is a bright and hot body, if cold and darkness are found to be the consequences of its withdrawment. This is a glorious parallel to God. And the more constantly and necessarily these effects are connected with and confined to its absence, the more strongly does it argue the sun to be the fountain of light and heat. So, inasmuch as sin is not the fruit of any positive agency or influence of the Most High, but on the contrary, arises from the withholding of his action and energy, and under certain circumstances, necessarily follows on the want of his influence. This is no argument that he is sinful, or his operation sinful, or has anything of the nature of wickedness about it, but on the contrary, that he and his nature and his agency are altogether good and holy, and that he is the fountain of all holiness. It would be strange arguing, indeed, because men never commit sin but only when God leaves them to themselves, and necessarily sin, therefore, when he does so, that therefore their sin is not from themselves but from God, and so that God must be a sinful being. As strange as it would be to argue, because it is always dark when the sun is gone, and never dark when the sun is present, that therefore all darkness is from the sun, and that his disk and beams must needs be black. It properly belongs to the supreme and absolute governor of the universe to order all important events within his dominion by his wisdom. But the events in the moral world are of the most important kind, all of them are, such as the moral actions of intelligent creatures and their consequences. These events will be ordered by something. They will either be disposed by wisdom, or they will be disposed by chance. That is, they will be disposed by blind and undesigning causes, if that were possible, and could be called a disposal. Is it not better that the good and evil which happens in God's world should be ordered, regulated, bounded, and determined by the good pleasure of an infinitely wise being who perfectly comprehends within his understanding and constant view the universality of things in all their extent and duration, and sees all the influence of every event with respect to every individual thing and circumstance throughout the grand system and the whole of the eternal series of consequences, than to leave these things to fall out by chance and to be determined by those causes which have no understanding or aim? Doubtless, in these important events, there is a better and a worse, as to the time, subject, place, manner, and circumstance of their coming to pass, with regard to their influence or the state and course of things. And if there be, it is certainly best that they should be determined to that time, place, etc., which is best. And therefore, it is in its own nature fit that wisdom, and not chance, should order these things, so that it belongs to the being who is the possessor of infinite wisdom, and is the creator and owner of the whole system of created existences, and has the care of all. I say it belongs to him to take care of this matter, and he would not do what is proper for him if he should neglect it. And it is so far from being unholy in him to undertake this affair, that it would rather have been unholy to neglect it, as it would have been a neglecting what fitly appertains to him, and so it would have been a very unfit and unsuitable neglect. On the whole, it is manifest that God may be, in the manner which has been described, the orderer and disposer, the regulator, the director, the operator, the contriver of all, the orderer and disposer of that event, which, in the inherent subject and agent, is moral evil, and yet his so doing, that is, God's so doing, may be no moral evil, that is, no sin for him to do so. And I'd just like to interject at this point that when we do emphasize that God is the source of all, and this includes all evil, and evil includes all human sin and wickedness, that, and yet it is in the sense as when the sun goes over the horizon, you know, that that's all that is left. And I think that is very helpful to us, to see that, and yet to see that that is all man has in him, and that is all that can, that all that can come out. Well, it's important for us to stand for this. But I would want to stand just as much so, and certainly I'd like to emphasize it more, and I even apologize for not doing so more, and perhaps we'll be able to do it more so in the future, that God is also the maker, the creator of good. Everything that is glorious and pretty and beautiful and loving and wise and good and holy and just and ideal, everything that is of good report and commendable, God has created, regulated, directed, and operated all of those things as well. He is responsible, the source of all of those things as well. And for all the evil that is in the world, all the suffering and all the tension and pain in ourselves, in everyone else, within and without, everywhere, nonetheless, there is so much good and so much beauty in our world, and so appreciative we ought to be of the many kindnesses and blessings and good things that are common to man and that all of us enjoy. And these things don't happen by so-called chance or free will either. These things come by God's glorious disposal and by His provision, His kindness being directed toward all. So let's remember that as well. And yet recall that He's not making any mistake in the evil that He creates, which become men's mistakes when they do them, when He leaves them to themselves. And what happens in leaving them to themselves in a given matter is that their own resources prove so unsatisfactory and come to be even an exceedingly bad failures in so many cases. He may will the disposal of such an event, that is, an event of evil, which is man's sin, and it's coming to pass for good ends, and His will not be an immoral or sinful will, but a perfectly holy will, and He may actually, in His providence, so both dispose and permit things, that is, cause them, in a certain sense, to bring them to pass, and then not act when they transpire so that they wouldn't occur, that is, to dispose and permit things, that the event may be certainly and infallibly connected with such disposal and permission, and His act therein not be an immoral or unholy, but a perfectly holy act. Sin may be an evil thing, and yet that there should be such a disposal and permission as that it should come to pass may be a good thing. This is no contradiction or inconsistence by any means. Joseph's brethren selling him into Egypt, consider it only as it was acted by them, and with respect to their views and aims, which were evil, it was a very bad thing, but it was a good thing, as it was an event of God's ordering, and considered with respect to His views and aims, which were good. Genesis 50, verse 20, as for you, you thought evil against me, but God meant it unto good. So the crucifixion of Christ, if we consider only those things which belong to the event, as it proceeded from His murderers, and are comprehended within the compass of the affair, considered as their act, their principles, dispositions, views, and aims. So, it was one of the most heinous things that ever was done, in many respects the most horrid of all acts, but consider it as it was willed and ordered of God in the extent of His design and views, you know, what He determined before to come to pass, as Acts chapter 4 brings out, according to His counsel and designation beforehand, and considered thus as it was ordered and willed of God in the extent of His designs and views, it was the most admirable and glorious of all events, and God's willing the event and causing the event, as Isaiah testifies, was the most holy volition of God that ever was made known to men, and God's act in ordering it was a divine act, which above all others manifest the moral excellency of the divine being. You see, brethren, here we are really getting into the very depths of God and His great and profound wisdom, and we are in areas that call for reverence and seriousness and careful, thoughtful, sober attention. Of course, I have recommended A. E. Knox's work, The Problem of Evil and the Judgments of God, before, and I would do so again, and especially recommend the article on the theme we've just considered of how an act is the worst thing imaginable in one sense and the best thing conceivable in another, in the article entitled Sin's Justification. That's right, there is the justification of sin. The article begins on page 157. And, of course, just to give you a preview for those of you who haven't read it, there is no justifying it in itself, but there is justifying it in a temporary expediency toward a good end. That God's purpose is never for that sin and is never for any evil. It's always for the good to come at the latter time. But we justify the sin and we justify the evil and the wickedness during the aeonian times because of God's great goal of becoming all in all and nullifying sin, abolishing death, and becoming all in all to His glory in indescribable grace and love that we can even now begin to touch upon just a bit and will be growing in, we trust, throughout our whole life of faith. So this is a matter of sin's justification. No, we wouldn't justify it in itself any more than anyone else, but we thank God that He can justify its presence. He can actually make it to be right so that we can declare it to be right, that it should be rather than not be, because of what He is going to bring out of it, and see that it was wise and best that it should be present rather than to be prevented. I would like to reply briefly against the charge that is made that people have the opinion that it wouldn't be right to judge people as those who are irresponsible, that is, that who could not have avoided their acts. And that is exactly our position, lest I be charged with being ambiguous, which is not too likely. That is our position. We recognize that, and we see God's wisdom in hand, goodness and love in it all. Some have said, well, that doesn't make sense. Well, now, if we would carefully consider their words, we will find that it is not that it doesn't make sense, that they are really saying, if we would look a bit deeper, they are saying that they do not approve. It's not a matter of whether it's sensible. It may not be sensible to them, but if they're foolish, that shouldn't surprise us. The real point is that they don't consider it right, and that's what they ought to say. But, of course, God is not being judged before the bar of human ethics or what the flesh may variously opine as to what it says is right and wrong. For instance, let's look at a tremendous example of the judgment of Yahweh in Isaiah chapter 10, verse 5. Woe, Assyria, club of my anger. Now, the Assyrian king being spoken of here is said to be God's club. He is the instrument, and His soldiers under Him are as much His instrument as if God were a man and He had a club in His hand. But He is not a man, and He does not have a club in His hand, but there is a likeness between Assyria and a literal club in that they are being used as if they were a club. And a rod, He, in their hand, is my menace. Among a nation polluted will I send him. Not that I will allow him to go. It doesn't say that. It says, I will send him. And against a people, object of my rage, the people of Israel in view here, will I instruct him. That is, He was given instruction to go and sent and used as a club to loot, loot, and to plunder, plunder, and to place them, the people of Israel, for tramping, to put them down in order to tramp on them as the clay of the streets. Yet He, that is the Assyrian king, not so is he planning, and his heart not so is devising. That is, he doesn't think so. Yet he, not so is he planning, and his heart not so is devising. For to exterminate is in his heart, and to cut off nations not a few. He thinks he's running things, you see, and he has his own purposes in mind. But in fact, looking behind the scenes, as Paul says in Romans 9, revealing the hidden facts, what is it that that which apprises says? Well, here we have the true appraisal of the matter, that God instructed him and sent him and used him as a club to do these things, even though that wasn't what the king of Assyria had in mind. Nonetheless, the true facts are that's the way it is. And he wasn't planning and devising it that way. For, that is, the king wasn't, for, saying is he, are not my chiefs altogether kings? Is not Ash-Carchemish Calno? Should not as Arphad be Hamath? Should not as Damascus be Samaria? The idea is, I've conquered these other areas, can I not conquer the rest? As my hand found all the kingdoms of the forbidden idols and their carvings more than Jerusalem and than Samaria's, shall I not, as I did to Samaria and to her forbidden idols, so do to Jerusalem and to her grief fetishes, the idolatry of wickedness that the people of Jerusalem had then descended into? Yet it comes when Yahweh will clip off all his doings, that is, the doings of this Assyrian king, in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem. I will visit evil on the fruit of the insolent heart of the king of Assyria and the high beauty of his eyes. See, the fruit of his insolent heart of this king of Assyria was that he thought he was doing these things for his glory and for his purpose, when all the time he was instructed and sent by Yahweh to be doing them. And this was the fruit or the result of what came out of his insolent heart. And the evil would be visited upon that result or fruit of his heart and the high beauty of his eyes, thinking how great he was and not recognizing that he's merely a piece of pottery. For, says he, the king, by the vigor of my hand I did it, and by my wisdom for understanding have I. He's not going to be punished for having done so-called free will sin. He is going to be judged and have evil visited upon him because he thinks he did these things of himself when all the time he was instructed and sent by Yahweh to be doing them and was a mere club in the hand of the deity. And yet he thought that by his own hand he did it, and by his own wisdom and his understanding that he thought it was his own. And I am taking away the boundaries of the people, and their equipment I rob. Well, in a secondary sense he was, but he didn't know God, you see. And I am bringing down as a sturdy one their dwellers, and my hand is finding as a nest the estate of the peoples. And as one gathers forsaken eggs, the entire earth do I gather. He was just so taken up with being a potter when he was actually a pot. And no one comes to be ruffling a wing, the king says, or opening wide the mouth and chirping. That is, he could just go out and do whatever he wanted and no one bothered him. And yet here is God's reply to that man who was actually his club. Will the axe beautify itself over the one hewing with it? Should the chief's mace magnify itself over the one waving it? As if a club is also waving the one raising it. I mean, how foolish. As if a club is also waving the one raising it. No, the king was the club. God was the one raising the club. As if a rod is raising one who is not wood. Wherefore, because the king was thinking these foolish things, the Lord, Yahweh of hosts, will send upon his stout ones leanness, and under his glory will glow a glowing as the glowing of fire. And the light of Israel will come to be a fire, and his Holy One to be a blaze. Well, this gives us an illustration of how God actually uses humans by his contriving of all, and they are carrying out his counsel. They're the men of his counsel, which he brings to pass by simply leaving them to what is in them and putting them in certain circumstances. He arranges and directs these matters so that it will infallibly follow what he intends, and yet without directly causing them to do so, but yet indirectly causing them to do so because of having made them in a certain way and put them in certain circumstances, knowing the laws of his entire creation and what will infallibly transpire and follow as a consequence of his prior disposal. A good example of this whole matter would be A.A.K.'s article, The Deity of God, beginning on page 211 in the book on the problem of evil. The argument is set forth, if God purposed that sin should enter the world, why does he cast Satan into the lake of fire for doing what it was planned he should do? Well, on the surface, this question seems reasonable and right, but beneath its demand for fairness lies the most malignant of all sins. God is put in the same category with man. He is placed on trial by a jury of his peers. He is called to account as though he were a criminal, and we were gods, high and mighty, and far more just than he. It denies his deity. It undermines his supremacy. Man takes his empty throne and is seated in the place of power. What the great apostle of the nations was confronted with the equivalent of this question, he did not even deign to answer it. Romans 9:19. None who ask it can be enlightened unless, first of all, they take the place which becomes them. They take the place which becomes them in his august presence. So we echo the apostle's reply. Of those who seek to overthrow the truth by questioning God's right to do what he does, we simply ask, who are you? Who are you? We have no controversy with them. Their quarrel is with God. Until they bow to the Creator and acknowledge that they are merely creatures, his ways will be hidden and his doings devious and dark. As we said, I think, at the very early part of the study on the first recording, that a prerequisite to grasping most any scriptural subject, and especially this theme, is if we would be becoming wise in those things which are of the Spirit of God, we must become stupid in the so-called wisdom of this eon. That's a prerequisite. Mr. Nock wrote on page 218 in regard to Pharaoh, whose heart was hardened so that he would not let the people go and so that God's glory would be proclaimed throughout the entire earth in the great judgments that he would bring upon Egypt. Mr. Nock said this, one day in regard to Pharaoh, well may he exclaim, blessed be the God who used my unworthy self to exalt his name and spread his fame. It is an honor to have been trodden beneath his feet. Remember that judgment involves setting right, and all will be set right for Pharaoh, and God is fond of him, and Pharaoh is part of the world that God loves. So keeping these things in mind, and the very character of God, he's not unmindful of how he has dealt with him or with any other human being, whether they've been a vessel of mercy or a vessel of indignation or the great varieties of people within those two great classes. So keeping these things in mind and remembering those who undergo the most are going to have the greatest blessing when they're delivered out of it, and so that there is a compensation for everything, and no one is going to be gypped, in the vernacular, if you will, in the long run, and it will all have the books balanced ideally. There's no complaining when it all is said and done, and anything that appears superficially or temporarily unjust or unsatisfactory will not be so when judging is completed and God becomes all in all. Then we will have the wisdom that he already has to see the useful purpose that everything, and I do mean everything, along the way served, and that it was best that each thing should be as it was rather than otherwise, because it is the counsel of God's own will according to which he operates all, that is, what he chooses or prefers or sees to be best as the basis of the advice that he takes from no one but his own choice, and then operates according to that choice. When we see these things, we'll just marvel and glory indescribably in his greatness and his wisdom, and see that everything was best to be just as it was, and was for the highest good, and that was never at the expense of anyone in the long run. It was all just and good, and no one suffered unjustly, because God will compensate all for all they go through in one way or another by the consummation. Actually, God treats all mankind the way that even human courts here in America deal with minors. when they see a child that even these human judges are sensible enough to see that under the circumstances that they had in a home, that they were not responsible for the things they got into with their actions. They imagine, due to their disqualified minds, that some people are responsible for their actions, but they even have the sensibility to see that in some cases, at least, minors, at least, and even some adults, are not responsible in some cases, and yet they still bring them into judgment for their sake, and for the sake of society, and for reform, and for warning, and for correction and safety. So there are good reasons for judgment. We're not doing away with judgment or anything of the kind. We're rather seeing its true place, and that God is bringing indignation on the irreverence and the unjustness of men. But he recognizes those creatures for what they are, his pottery in his hands. Well, in the portion of our study that remains, I'd like to read to you excerpts from an article by Vladimir Jelesnov that appeared in Volume 5 of Unsearchable Riches magazine, long out of print. That volume was from October 1913 to August 1914, and Vladimir Jelesnov's article begins thus: The Problem of Evil. There is probably no subject that confronts mortals which is more perplexing than the problem of evil. It looms up as a dark mystery and deep, with absolutely no clue to guide us through the tangled maze and riddle of the universe. This is really the idea entertained by Christians generally. Yet, all down the centuries, the scriptures have supplied a thread of exodus from the labyrinth of this great cosmic problem that presses upon the human mind for solution. The question of the origin of evil has been the one which has mostly engrossed the thought of thinkers. To contrive some way whereby evil might have first come into existence, and at the same time clear God from all responsibility in the matter, has been the chief endeavor of those who have written on the subject. And yet it seems evident that the fact of the existence of evil, quintessent from its origin, is the real crux after all. That is simply to say that the fact is not only the origin of it, but what is it doing here? Why doesn't he get rid of it? That is even a greater question to ask, and all have to allow that. It is self-evident that an absolutely supreme deity must be a universally responsible deity. God must be responsible for whatever state of things obtains, or, what is tantamount to it, responsible for that chain of causes that led to this state of things. If God cannot alter this evil state of things, then he is not omnipotent. If he will not, then he is not all-loving, unless he has a purpose to accomplish which justifies the employment of evil. Did not God suffer evil to enter the universe in the first place when he might have prevented it? We certainly must answer affirmatively, for the negation of this statement deprives him of supremacy. The negation of the statement that he could have prevented evil from effecting an entrance deprives the universe of a supreme head and sets it aimlessly whirling in space, a sport of blind, impersonal forces, with no governing hand above and beyond it. If, then, God allowed evil when he was able to avert it, there is no evading the issue that he is responsible for all the consequences that have followed in its trail, and the only way to vindicate him is to take the ground that God has a purpose in evil, which, while augmenting his glory, secures a higher degree of blessedness for the creature, that is, than would otherwise ever be. When we think of it seriously, it seems as if, in their treatment of the question of evil, the sacred writers were rather unguarded and careless in their expressions. Some of their assertions seemed to border on irreverence, and to some, even a positive offense to moral sensibility. How much so may be inferred from the painful assiduity with which expositors have labored to tone down their language. As an example of the boldness of sacred writers, we will instance the oft-repeated statement, all things are of God. Romans 11:36, 2 Corinthians 8:6, 11:12, Ephesians 1:11, Hebrews 2:10. The majority of Christians profess to believe it, but their actual views qualify the apostle's statement. Quote, "It is impossible to believe this statement in toto," unquote, they say. Quote, "Had the phrase been used of things Paul heard when rapt into the third heaven, or of the things John beheld when soaring in spirit over the new earth, we would have no difficulty in taking it literally. But surely we cannot be expected to take the phrase absolutely when it is used of a world groaning in pain and reeking in crime. Paul did not mean that absolutely all things are of God, the bad things as well as the good, all the crime and sin and wickedness. What he really wished to say is that all good things are of God." Unquote. But I might add and interject here in Brother Jellicknoff's article that, in fact, even the theologians that say that are hypocrites because they don't really believe that all good things are of God, for they think that he only made the good events in the affairs of men possible, because these things are all supposedly held over the pit of free will, as it were, as well, so that they see man as the real key to the good, even as to the evil. Returning to the article, "But the apostle knew what he said. His purpose was to reveal and enlighten, not to confuse and mystify. He was fully aware that his teaching was open to objections, criticism, misrepresentation. Having those possibilities in mind, as a man of mature experience, trained in rhetoric and philosophy, writing on so momentous a theme, he would be very cautious in his language and state his thoughts with sufficient clearness to be understood. We must accept his declaration as it stands, and not import into it conclusions which were handed down to us. Nor is Paul alone in teaching that all things are of God. The same truth, in the plainest terms and in the most positive manner, all the sacred writers affirm. And no Christian would think of doubting it were it not for the fact that it is at variance with received ideas. An absolutely supreme God is necessarily a universally responsible God, and such is, as we shall see, the clear, positive, unmistakable teaching of Scripture. To this universal responsibility, evil is no exception, but rather a spatially designated feature, inasmuch as God declares himself to be its creator," Isaiah 45:7. On this passage, more anon, that is later. Meanwhile, it is evident that in explaining it away, the only alternative was to fall back on the dualism of the Zoroastrian system and divide the universe into two opposite realms with a rival god over each. But whereas Zoroastrianism teaches that evil will eventually cease to exist, according to the belief of Christendom, the devil emerges from the conflict with a larger following than God, and devildom secures for itself a permanent place in God's universe. Is it any wonder that thinking men and women turn away from a theology which is a tissue of glaring and palpable contradictions? God rules over all. He doeth whatsoever is done in heaven or in earth. He assumes full responsibility. Hence, the same act, such as inciting David to number the people, which in one place is attributed to the adversary, is in another place ascribed directly to God. 1 Chronicles 21:1, compare 2 Samuel 24:1. In like manner, Job's afflictions, represented as inflicted by the adversary in one place, are spoken of as due to the hand of God. The adversary smote Job with the botch of Egypt, Job 2:7, just as his acquaintance come to condole over all the evil which Jehovah had brought upon him, 42:11. On the forefront of Revelation, the story of Joseph eloquently proclaims the truth that evil things are of God just as much as good things. His brethren had made up their mind to destroy him. Dissuaded from their murderous intent, they sell him into slavery, and in order to cover up their crime, shamefully deceive their aged father. The sin of Joseph's brethren was dark-dyed, and yet in the course of years, when Joseph became ruler of Egypt, and is at last made known to his brethren, he comforts them by saying, "Now, therefore, be not grieved nor angry with yourselves, that ye sold me hither, for God did send me before you to preserve life. So now, it was not you that sent me hither, but God." Genesis 45:5-8. It is thus evident that God had willed to bless the world through the sufferings of Joseph, so that in selling their brother, Jacob's sons carried out the will of God. And it is equally evident that while carrying out the will of God, their hearts were not right towards him, and the calamities of God's trying providence which came upon them were designed as a corrective. Does not this prove to demonstration that all things are of God? I will now advert to an example all the more powerful because it seems trite and commonplace. I mean the case of Samson. While in Timnath, he became infatuated with a Philistine damsel and was determined to marry her. To the arguments of his parents, who tried to persuade him against a marriage condemned by Moses' law, Samson replies, "Get her for me, for she pleaseth me well." None would even dream that God had anything to do with this foolish love affair, and yet the record reads, quote, "His father and his mother wist not they did not know that it was of the Lord, for he sought an occasion against the Philistines." Judges 14:4. The extermination of the royal house of Ahab is another illustration of how evil things are of God. 1 Kings 21:19-29. The accomplishment of it is detailed in 2 Kings 9:10. It is a sickening tale of cunning, truce-breaking, treachery, cruelty, barbarous butchery, and yet it was the carrying out of Jehovah's purpose. In 1 Kings 21:21, God says, "I will cut off from Ahab every man-child, and him that is shut up, and him that is left at large in Israel." He is in the crimes and wickedness of men in such sense that he makes them subserve his own wishes and brings good out of them in the end, having contrived them in the first place. For all is contrived by Yahweh for his response, and even the wicked one is being kept for the day of evil. "I will contrive, and who will reverse it?" he declares. Proverbs 16:4 and Isaiah 43:13.